No one else has recalled the paint store or Lowell Mumford. Could you just tell me about Lowell, what he was like?
He was a mad one. He'd paint you if you stood still too long. Yeah, no, he was all right. Very busy all the time, of course, because he always had plenty to do. But he was all right.
And his
friends used to get on with him pretty well, really. Yeah.
He was a jovial sort of bloke.
He was what?
Was he a jovial sort of bloke, Johnny?
Yeah, he was all right, like most people were in those days. Yeah.
And his paint store, what sort of colours of paint did he tend to paint the castings? Because from the photos...
Greys mainly, greys and light blues and this sort of thing. Yeah, and black. Yeah, not much variety, you know. But they didn't mix together very well.
Good industrial colours.
Of course, one of the larks was, Lowell would come in with a pot of paint and put it down and start painting. Then he'd go away to the toilet or somewhere, so we'd pinch his paint and go and hide it somewhere else. You know? Which didn't please him very much. But this was young man, you know, this was 16, 7-year-old having a bit of fun. You know.
Was it Tom Mumford, his brother, the gate man?
He only had one arm, anyway. He lost an arm in the war, I think, in the First World War, I think it was. And he used to look after it. There was a little box down by the main gate. And there was a doorway there, big shutter door into the heavy, bottom end of the heavy machine shop.
And I've heard that he was quite a stickler. He was a very strict man.
Oh, yeah. You didn't get into fieldings unless you were had a reason for being so. Oh, yeah. But the interesting thing was, you see, that the men like that around the factory got to know all the apprentices. They knew who you were and where you were working. So you wouldn't get a stranger sneak in, you know, because he wouldn't know you. You know, Tom. Yeah, it was Tom, that's right. Tom Bumford.
And he made sure that people weren't late for work as well as making sure that it was only workers that got in.
No, that wasn't his responsibility. Now, if you came in the main gate and there was the main drag up there, the clocking stations were here. The timekeeper was Jack Morris. And he was an ogre with Jack Morris. He would stand by the clock because you had 3 minutes on the clock to get in. And he would see you coming up the drag, and he'd watch the clock click over the 3 minutes, and then he'd lock it. He wouldn't give you any latitude at all. So consequently, then you'd lose half an hour's money. Yeah. Jack Morris. He was the timekeeper for the whole works, you know. He was worse with the apprentices than he was with the journeymen, you know. Yeah. But you had to be on time, otherwise Jack would lock you out. And in fact, it has been known for him to lock the clock and send you home again. Come back this afternoon, you'd lose half a day's money.
And why would he have made you lose half a day? Was that just how he felt at the time?
How he felt at the time, yeah.
So you didn't want to catch him on a bad day?
Or if you were a regular latecomer, you know, he'd make you pay for your sins, you know, send you home again. Never happened to me, as it happened, but, yeah. Because, I mean, some people couldn't get there on time to save their life, you know.
And how did you get to work then? Did you cycle? Where were you coming from?
I lived in Tudor Street, which was down the Bristol Road. Now then, I had a problem. I had to pass Moreland's Match Factory. You had to be very careful. There were no Sammy's Angels outside Moreland's factory. Because if there were, and you weren't quick enough to get by, they would grab you. And the minimum you would lose would be your trousers. Do you know what I mean by Sammy's Angels? That's the girls who worked in Moreland's, in the match factory.
Why would they give... Oh, Samuel Moreland's.
Yeah.
So Sammy's Angels. Okay.
An industrial estate. Yeah. Oh, they were shockers. Yeah, and I had to pass them every day, not in the mornings because they'd already been in, but when I came back if I used to go home to lunch, which I used to, coming back then, they would still be out, and they'd be congregated along the front of Morning's factory. So I used to run like hell down the other side of the road.
I guess
I never got caught, but I know some who did. Yeah.
And they lost their trousers.
Yeah.
I guess if you went in your boiler suit, that was harder to get off.
Yeah, well, some did and some didn't, you know. I never did because my mother wouldn't let me go in the house with a dirty boiler suit on.
We were talking before about the heavy erecting shop and the slight slope going down and the paint stores. What else were the sights of the room, the sights, the smells? How big was the heavy erecting shop?
It was quite a big shop. Yeah, the heavy erecting shop. I bet we're close on 100 yards long, you know, and 20 or 30 yards wide. Had two big pits in it, because, of course, the big presses would be built in a pit because they would be so tall, you see. But I remember we built one press, and I think it was the press that went out to the Argentine for pressing motor bodies. And we had to take the roof off to finish the job outside.
Wow, no one has mentioned that before. Can you just tell us a bit more about that?
I was working in the shop at the time, and it was the biggest press that Fieldings had ever built. And I'm pretty sure it was for the Argentine. But right on the top were two tanks, oil tanks, because it was oil hydraulics on that one, not water. There were two big tanks on the top, connected together with a pipe and a balancing valve in the middle. And we couldn't build those tanks onto the top without taking the roof off the shop. So we had to take the roof off, which was only corrugated steel, of course, and then build a little sort of tent structure over the top to get the rain out. Yeah.
How long did that take, to take the roof off and construct the tent and then finish off the press?
A couple of days, I expect. Yeah. And, of course, you were working up in the flipping air on the top of the press, you know.
Did you built scaffolding around the press to get up that high, did you?
No, you had ladders up the side that were actually part of the press. You know, ladders up the side. Not such a thing as health and safety in those days, you know.
How high up would you have been?
30, 40 feet, I suppose. Yeah.
And that's how high up the cranes would have been as well in the heavy erecting, above the cranes.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I'm just trying to think, we got those tanks up there. If I remember right, we had to build, they were lifted up as far as they could go on the cranes and onto some scaffolding, and then we had to build some craneage to get them up further and put them on the top of the press. Yeah.
Was that the trickiest job that you ever did when you were at Fieldings?
Oh, God, no, I can't say that because I can't remember all of them. You know, but I that was one job I did work on, was that press. Yeah, that was in the big pit, and there was a smaller pit further up. We used to build the stone plants in the sometimes in there, but not very often. They were built in the light assembly shop, usually. Stone plants. A lot of them were, of course, stone plants. Yeah.
And thinking about fitting something in the heavy erecting shop, assembling it and putting it together, how many men would have worked on a big job at any one time, putting it together?
Oh, could be as many as a dozen. Yeah, could be as many as a dozen. And then, of course, the electricians would come in to put all the electrical work in. And there was one fitter who used to do all the assembly work away from the factory, Roly Templeman. When you were getting towards the finish of the press, he would come in and spend some time with it because he'd be the man responsible for putting it in wherever it had to go, you know. Yeah, poor old Roly. We built some extrusion presses for Poland at the time of the Cold War. And he went out there with the first one. And they took his passport off him in Poland. And they wouldn't let him home until the second one was delivered. But Fieldings hadn't been paid for the first one. So Fielding sat on the second one, and poor old Rowley was in the middle. They wouldn't, like, stuck out in Poland, they wouldn't let him home. And the government got involved in that. Yeah.
How many men would have worked in the heavy erecting shop altogether?
30, I suppose, something like that. Yeah.
And would that include the crane drivers?
There was only one crane driver in that. That was, she was called the lady crane driver in the heavy erecting shop. Think of her name now.
It wasn't Mary Hamp, was it?
Mary was her name, that's right. Mary. Yeah.
And what was she like? How was she regarded by the men that worked there?
Oh, she was all right. But of course, she had a boyfriend. Alf Hall was in the pump shop, was her, you know, which everybody knew, and they thought they didn't, you know. Yeah, she was all right, Mary. Yeah. She used to rattle around in his crane. And then there was another crane in the heavy machine shop, but that was operated from the floor with them. And there was another one in the light erecting job, again, which was operated from the floor. Yeah. Mary had a position of responsibility, of course. But nobody was allowed to sling a job for the crane to lift, only the slingers. That was a skilled job, because, of course, they had to look at it and see where the balance was, you know, and get the chains or ropes in the right place. People, you know.
And no one's really mentioned the slingers before. How many slingers would have worked at Fieldings, and do you remember them, well, their names?
Only two or three, that's all. Yeah. They used to use ropes and chains, of course. Of course, the ropes had to be checked every so often by the government department responsible for that. That was in the early days of safety, you know. And they'd have a metal label on them with a date on, and you wouldn't use them beyond that date. But as I said, that was Slinger's job. Nobody else was allowed to do that.
It's very interesting that they had the date on the ropes. Mm. Thinking about some of the other areas of the factory, the areas that weren't used as part of the works, the canteen, say. Did you use the canteen?
If you came from the training school back towards the factory, you went into a covered area, which was a store area, and over on the far side of there was the first aid room on the ground floor. And then there's some stairs there, and up above that was the canteen. Yeah.
And how big was that room?
Oh, it wasn't very big. Not many people used the canteen.
And you said that you went home for lunch sometimes. So you wouldn't. Did you ever see the inside of the canteen?
I occasionally used the canteen if there was any particular reason. But if you wanted a meal in the canteen lunchtime, then you had to book it first thing in the morning so that they knew how many they had to cater for. Yeah.
And what was the food like?
Oh, the food was fine. Yeah, the food was fine. Well, I can remember anyway. And then the canteen used to send, and two or three ladies used to go around the factory during the day with tea and buns and the rest of it, you know. But in the training school, one lad was allocated every day to go to the canteen and fetch it. He was the tea, there were two of them winning, it was one to fetch the tea and one to fetch the buns.
Was that a job that apprentices generally enjoyed?
Oh, yeah. You should get a free bun out of it, usually. Yeah.
Did you ever have to run any other errands when you were in the apprentice school or when you were indeed an apprentice during your time there?
You had to do what you were asked to do, you know. Of course, apprentices were used to do some of the more mundane jobs, For instance, and I'll tell you a funny story, there was a cellar. If you came up the main drag, it was on the left-hand side, because, of course, it's on the old church where I was baptized, the old St. Luke's Church. It was on that site. Because where the bicycle sheds was always called the churchyard, and there were, in fact, tombstones laid flat in that area. But on the other side of the drag was a cellar underneath the heavy machine shop. And we used to keep down there all the greases and tallows and all sorts of paint and all sorts of things down there. And very often an apprentice would be sent down there to get some tallow or get some grease, you see. But you had to be careful. You open two flaps in the road, and then there was a step going down. And when you got onto the top step, there was a light switch on the one of these up and down light switches on the wall. And you would put the lights on, and the rats would go everywhere. Oh, yeah. And I'm not talking little rats. I'm talking monsters. All colors. Black, gray, brown, black and white. They used to come out of the dock basin, you see. And they used to get after the tallow and the grease. And the rest of it. And I remember one day, there was a young lad from Stroud named Shooter, young apprentice, and he wasn't very big. And I was told to take him down the cellar to get some grease so that he'd know where to go in the future, you see. Now, the grease was always kept in 25-gallon drums with a lid on. So I said to young Shooter, I said, "Now, look, don't worry," I said, "put the light on, wait for the rats to disappear." And that sort of made him think a bit, you know. Anyway, we did that, put the light on, all the rats disappeared. I said, "Right, now the grease you want is in that 25-gallon drum there. You've got a can in your hand. All you got to do is take the lid off, put your arm down in the drum, scoop some grease out, and then put the lid back on." Right? Well, what must have happened, of course, is that a rat had got into the grease, couldn't get out, and somebody had put a lid on. I didn't know that. So young Shooter takes the lid off, puts his arm in, the rat runs up his arm, across his shoulders, and away, and he fainted on the spot. And I had to pick him up and carry him to the first aid room. Good job, he was only a little. Yeah, but now these rats get everywhere. Yeah.
Did they have a vermin inspector or someone that would put down rat poison?
No, not in those days, no. The other interesting thing with rats was if you were on nights in the fitting shop and you were working on the bench, so you'd have a light over your bench and the rest of the shop might be in darkness and you could sense you were being watched. No, it's true. You could sense you were being watched. And if you looked up all along the hot water pipes, you see little eyes twinkling down because the rats used to get up there in the warm at night. And if you opened your bait box and put a couple of sandwiches down where you closed the box, they'd be gone. They'd pinch your supper. Oh, it's riddled with rats. And there was a store there, and very often a rat would go in there and die. And after a couple of months, you knew he was in there, you know. So he said, "Take everything out of the store, find the body, cremate it, and put everything back again."
That's wonderful. No one else has talked about the rats, or indeed the stores under the heavy machine shop. That's fascinating, and yeah. Great to know that that's where they kept all of the stuff.
I've been wondering since they built the quays, what happened to that cellar? I suppose they must have filled it in, you know, because it was the old crypt of the church, you see. At least I think it was. Yeah. But that was the only cellar that I knew of on the fielding site was that.